who are dark up and blue. Don't let us hang around this town and let what others say come true. We're just good for nothing, they all figure. A boy's grown up shiftless jitter.
Peace, everyone, and welcome to Darker Than Blue, another episode of Darker Than Blue. I am Jackie Lukeman. I'm so glad you are here with me today. And man, we have a lot to talk about. And interesting how my teleprompter thingy is not working the way it should. So let's just do this the old-fashioned way, shall we? thank you so much for joining me here on Darker Than Blue today. This is the show where we talk about politics for the people that you just heard Brother Curtis Mayfield say are darker than blue. And you know, sometimes things just things will do what they will do. Technology does what it does, and we continue on as we can with all of this. There is so much going on, ladies and gentlemen. There is so much to discuss, but I wanted to start with some history. Okay, so let's go. Beginning on January 19th, 1930, mobs of up to 500 white people roamed Watsonville, California, and the surrounding towns and farms, attacking Filipino farm workers and their property after Filipino men were seen dancing with white women at a newly opened local dance hall. In the days and weeks before the rioting, politicians and community leaders had ramped up their anti-Filipino rhetoric, calling the farm workers a menace and demanding that Filipino residents be deported. So, quote, white people who have inherited this country for themselves and their offspring could live, end quote. That this really is how they think of themselves in relation to this country, or what they think of this country in relation to themselves. A local judge stated, quote, the worst part of the Filipino man being here is his mixing with young white girls from 13 to 17. They were very specific in that age range. He gives them silk underwear, the judge says, and makes them pregnant and crowds whites out of jobs in the bargain, end quote. One Watsonville mob was initially turned away from the dance hall by security guards and the armed owners of the hall, but returned in force to beat dozens of Filipino farm workers. The beatings continued elsewhere in the area, and on the night of January 22nd, a mob ransacked Filipino farm workers' homes and shot into the dwellings, killing Fermin Tobera. No one was ever charged with this murder. Seven men were later convicted of rioting, but received either probation or 30 days in jail. The anti-Filipino violence continued in California in the months after the Watsonville riots ended on January 23rd, with violence breaking out in Stockton, Salinas, San Francisco, and San Jose. In 1933, California enacted a law to prohibit marriages between Filipino and white residents. And in 1934, answering in part a longstanding request of California's government, Congress reduced Filipino immigration to the U.S. to just 50 people per year. In September 2011, the California legislature officially expressed regret and apologized for these events and actions, but ain't nobody send a check, so they can take their apology. And on January 20th, 1870, Hiram Rhodes Revels was elected to the Senate, becoming the first African-American to serve in the U.S. Congress. Mr. Revels was elected in Mississippi to fill the vacancy left after the state's secession from the Union. And it established, after the Confederacy's 1865 defeat, In the Civil War, Reconstruction amendments to the Constitution abolished slavery, established the citizenship of formerly enslaved Black people, and granted Black people civil rights, including granting Black men the right to vote. For a brief construction period, exactly, I think it was, 12 years, which lasted until 1867, federal officials and troops remained in Southern states and enforced those new rights. Why did they have to? Because did you really think that the former slave owners were just going to go ahead and treat their former property equally because the law said so? Oh, come on, please. Federal officials and troops remained in Southern states and enforced these new rights. As a result, Black people in the South were, for the first time, voters, political candidates, and election winners. Mr. Revels was one of those winners. However, immediately upon Mr. Revels' arrival in Washington, Southern white politicians, still committed to the idea of white supremacy and racial hierarchy, were determined to block his seating to Congress. They declared his election null and void. Yeah, they did, asserting various dubious objections, including a claim that Mr. Revels was ineligible for the Senate because, like all Black Americans, he was not a U.S. citizen until the passage of the 14th Amendment. They didn't want Black people to be citizens. And then the law said, yes, they are citizens. And they were like, no, forget that law. Hiram Revels was eventually seated in the Senate on February 25th, 1870, after a Senate vote of 48-8. However, the attempt to prevent Mr. Revels from taking his rightful place in office was an early illustration of the deeply rooted racial animus and belief in inequality that remained in the South and in the entire country. That would continue to terrorize and plague Black people for generations, especially after federal protection was withdrawn, after those federal troops were withdrawn from the South. And we talked about why that happened and who agreed to it and for what reason a couple of shows ago. Then on January 21st, 1948, Senator James Eastland of Mississippi led a successful campaign to block an anti-lynching bill that would have held members of lynch mobs and local law enforcement officers accountable for their role in racial terror lynchings. Before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee hearing, Senator Eastland, an ardent segregationist and supporter of white supremacy, proclaimed that time has cured lynchings and refused to acknowledge the role that law enforcement had played for decades in the lynchings of thousands of Black Americans. He knew law enforcement was involved. Everybody knew law enforcement was involved in lynchings. They just didn't care. And he said it. Senator Eastland, a wealthy plantation owner who served as U.S. Senator from Mississippi from 1942 to 1978, why a former plantation owner was allowed to be a U.S. Senator is one of the reasons we are in the mess we are in today, but that's a whole nother conversation. Anyway, Eastland was senator from Mississippi from 1942 to 1978, built his political career on promoting white supremacy, defending racial segregation, and blocking civil rights bills. His campaign to block anti-lynching legislation in the Senate was supported by dozens of Southern white politicians who successfully filibustered every anti-lynching bill since the first one was introduced in 1918. So folks who sit around today talking about Black folks aren't unified, we don't do this, we don't, shut up, you don't know history. That's why you believe that. Anyway, at the January 21st hearing, Senator Eastland launched unfounded attacks on the constitutionality of the anti-lynching bill, which would make lynching a federal crime, and disparaged the Supreme Court as not judicially honest. In contending there was no need for an anti-lynching bill, Senator Eastland incorrectly declared that, quote, we don't have any lynchings now, end quote. Though the summer, though the number of racial terror lynchings had declined by 1948, there were still more than four dozen lynchings recorded during the 1940s, including at least six in Senator Eastland's own state. He knew, and he knew he was lying. Senator Eastland's attempt to downplay the history and continued threat of lynching was particularly blatant, given that Mississippi is among the states with the highest number of documented racial lynchings from 1877 to 1950. His own family also had ties to racial terror violence. In 1904, the same year Eastland was born, his father, Woods Eastland, led a lynch mob that captured and brutally lynched a black man named Luther Holbert and an unidentified black woman without trial or due process of law. The two lynched victims were mutilated and burned alive before a crowd of 600 spectators. No one was ever punished for their deaths. Mr. Holbert had been accused of killing the future senator's plantation-owning uncle, for whom Eastland was named, but of course there was never any evidence that such an accusation was true. As the federal government refused to protect Black Americans, racial terror lynchings remained an ongoing threat to Black communities for nearly a century. This was also the result of the federal troops being removed from the South. Victims of racial terror lynchings were hanged, shot, stabbed, drowned, and burned alive, killed by mobs who never faced prosecution for their actions. It was not uncommon for lynch mobs to seize their victims from jails, prisons, courtrooms, or police custody. And in many cases, law enforcement officials were complicit or active participants in lynchings. The anti-lynching bill that came before the Senate in 1948 proposed to hold law enforcement accountable specifically for lynchings of people who were in their custody. Due to the efforts of Southern white politicians like Senator Eastland, the bill failed. Out of more than 200 anti-lynching bills introduced in Congress, only three passed the House and none passed the Senate until 2018. It was not until 2022 that the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act was passed by both houses of Congress, signed by President Biden on March 29, 2022, making lynching a federal hate crime. And that's the least Biden could have done, considering the fact that he bragged about Senator Eastland being one of his close friends and mentors. On January 22, 1953, the U.S. Court of Appeals ruled that restaurants in Washington, D.C. could continue refusing service to Black patrons. 3 years prior, 86-year-old civil rights activist Mary Church Terrell, my girl, began a lawsuit against Thompson's Restaurant, located a few blocks from the White House, which had denied service to her and several colleagues because they were Black. Mrs. Terrell invoked a set of laws outlawing racial discrimination in restaurants and other places of public accommodation that had been passed during Reconstruction following the Civil War by Washington, D.C.'s newly elected biracial government. Reconstruction is an incredibly important period of time that too few people in this country know about. In the 1870s, when the federal government retreated from the promise of racial progress ushered in by the Reconstruction era, what does that mean? The federal government withdrew the troops from the South. That's what they mean. It did so not just in the former Confederate states, but also in its own capital. Congress abolished the city's locally elected biracial government and replaced it with a federally appointed commission of white men. Segregation became deeply entrenched in the district, and these anti-discrimination laws, though never explicitly repealed, stopped being enforced. During the Jim Crow era, white Americans across the country who were committed to racial hierarchy thought it was really important to uphold racial exclusion in the nation's capital. After Mississippi Senator Theodore Bilbo in 1940 became chairman of the congressional committee responsible for overseeing the district, he told an audience, quote, "I wanted this position so I could keep Washington a segregated city," end quote. In ruling against Mrs. Terrell on January 22, 1953, the U.S. Court of Appeals declared that the district's Reconstruction government had lacked the authority to pass laws banning segregation, claiming only Congress had the power to do so. It also held that even if the Reconstruction government had held such authority, the laws could not be enforced because they had been disregarded for over 80 years. However, Mrs. Terrell and her legal team appealed the ruling to the Supreme Court, and 5 months later, on June 8, 1953, the court decided unanimously in her favor, in holding that the Reconstruction era anti-discrimination laws were still valid, and thus segregation in the district and restaurants was illegal. This ruling only applied to Washington, D.C., though. It would take over a decade with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 for segregation in public restaurants to be outlawed across the United States. The Reconstruction era is woefully understudied, but I'm fitting to try to fix that. On January 23rd, 1870, over 100 Blackfeet, most of whom were women, children, the elderly, and those suffering from disease were massacred by U.S. soldiers led by Major Eugene Baker near the Marias River, referred to as the Bear River by the Blackfeet, in the Montana Territory. At dawn, Major Baker and his men came upon a Blackfeet camp led by a man named Heavy Runner. The majority of the Blackfeet men had gone out to hunt while the rest of the band lay sleeping. Major Baker was told by a subordinate that the people in the camp were not engaged in a military conflict with the U.S. government. And that's a whole nother discussion right there, but that's what he said. Heavy Runner, after being awoken, presented papers to the U.S. soldiers attesting to friendly relations with U.S. authorities. In spite of proving that we're not at war with y'all, Heavy Runner was promptly shot, and Major Baker ordered his soldiers to attack the rest of the camp. The U.S. soldiers shot indiscriminately into lodges. They also shot at the tops of dwellings, so the structures would collapse upon the central fires and burn the people inside alive. According to a survivor who was taken prisoner during the massacre, U.S. soldiers killed 90 women, 50 children, and 15 men in Heavy Runner's band and destroyed 44 buildings. Other accounts put the number of Blackfeet murdered at over 200. A single member of the U.S. Army died. Neither Major Baker nor any of his genocidal men received disciplinary action for this atrocity. Major Baker's soldiers also stole over 100 horses and burned clothing and provisions, making it difficult for the surviving Blackfeet to endure the minus 30 degree temperatures. Many subsequently froze to death, which is exactly what Major Baker and his men intended, which is why they burned their clothes and food. The Marias River Massacre, also known as the Bear River Massacre or the Baker Massacre, was the largest massacre of indigenous people in present-day Montana, and one episode in the bloody campaign by the U.S. Army to dispossess the Blackfeet and other indigenous peoples of their territory. Whereas in the early 1800s, the Blackfeet had a population of about 20,000. By the end of the century, settler colonial violence, disease, and starvation brought the number down to just 5,000. A separate mass killing of indigenous people, known also as the Bear River Massacre, took place on January 29, 1863, when U.S. soldiers ambushed and killed at least 350 Shoshone people in present-day Idaho. And on January 23rd, 1963, Patricia Stevens Dew was arrested in the segregated lobby of the Florida Theater in Tallahassee for entering the whites-only section. Although the city dropped the case, Stevens Dew filed a lawsuit against the city for their support of racial apartheid, while an agreement was made that Dew would drop the suit if the city desegregated their courtroom. Not the movie theater, but the courtroom, the city went back on their promise, sparking a new wave of student protests of the movie theaters. Over 200 students were arrested and 37 were tear gassed in their efforts to desegregate the theaters. Stevens Dew's eyes were damaged by tear gas used by police during one of those protests. As a result, she had to wear dark glasses for the rest of her life. The city later changed its legal tactics, allowing students to peacefully protest in front of the theaters without police brutality and chemical assault. A few years earlier, but just to give you an idea of the kind of system Ms. Dew was, on February 20th, 1960, in Tallahassee, Miss Stevens Dew was fined and arrested at a Woolworth's lunch counter that denied African Americans the right to be seated. She refused to pay a fine and instead chose to stay in jail, a part of the jail no bail tactic that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee popularized. To learn more about Stevens Dew, read the book she wrote with her daughter, Tananarive Dew, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And that book is called Freedom in the Family, a mother-daughter memoir of the fight for civil rights. Now, dear friends, I wanted to open our discussion today with a history that happened this week that is directly connected to the violent, undemocratic, racist, xenophobic, illegal actions going on in several cities across the country right now, not just in Minneapolis. Now, if you did not know this history, if this is the first time you've heard about any of what I just said, I hope you noticed how familiar it all sounds to what is happening today and what has been happening in this country since this history was established. This history is vitally important to us understanding why what is happening today is happening, how we got to this point, who is responsible. We need to know this history because it helps us understand the nature of our present struggles and explains why we continue to experience this repression over and over and over again, it seems. We must do this. We must understand this history because there is widespread disunity and a lack of clarity among the masses about who we are fighting, why, and how we can defeat them. There is no common struggle for common goals because we are not clear on who our common enemies are, why they're at war with us, and how they carry out that war. This fractured reality in the U.S. is largely due to the lack of importance placed on understanding revolutionary theory. Some mistakenly believe that studying theory is a pointless academic exercise that movement leaders use to intimidate or control young organizers. Or, you know, some people believe that it's something that out of touch old movement veterans who are no longer engaged in the real work of organizing focus on, or that those who don't actually want to do any real work obsess over rather than focusing on and doing the work that needs to be done. However, none of that is true. Reading and understanding theory is key to organizing. It is the backbone that makes the work strategic, effective, and sustainable. Without understanding theory and the history that shapes it, there's no fundamental understanding of what is to be done about whatever is going on now. But this is not clear because maybe people misunderstand what theory itself is. Theory is not an educated guess. It's not a hypothesis, that's what a hypothesis is, it's an educated guess, that precipitates tests to prove or disprove it, right? That's not what a theory is. Let's be clear that theory is a set of ideas and principles that comes when one observes and analyzes facts and then seeks to answer the questions why, how, who causes this to happen. Theory helps determine potential actions or outcomes by identifying cause and effect through observing patterns in material realities, providing a lens for interpreting the world, and making informed decisions. Theory is not a guess. So in science, the theory of evolution is not a guess about how evolution happens, but an explanation of how evolution happens based on observations and the study of data. Marxist theory is the analysis of class conflict in the context of social economics. Critical race theory analyzes the way systemic racism is institutionalized through laws, policies, practices. None of these theories are guesses about these topics, but the outcomes of analyzing the facts involving those topics. Theory helps us name exactly what we are fighting. It's what allows us to move beyond general concerns about poverty to understand what causes and maintains poverty, which are capitalism, classism, white supremacy, patriarchy, imperialism, right? This helps us focus on those dynamics that create poverty rather than just putting a band-aid on the problem and leaving the cause untouched. Without theory, reform policies that most people focus on all the time, the band-aid, are usually identified as the answer to the problem without theory. For example, in the case of concerns about poverty, the reform might be to campaign for a higher federal minimum wage, which is absolutely necessary considering the federal minimum wage has been a paltry $7.25 an hour since 2009, while the cost of living has increased at a much higher rate. But with theory, people understand that raising the federal minimum wage is not enough to solve poverty, because they're fighting against the exploitative class dynamics of capitalism itself, not just the lack of an adequate minimum wage. Theory doesn't rule out the need for reforms to provide immediate relief or correction in some cases. Yeah, theory doesn't say, no, you can't solve any part of this problem until you, no, that's not what theory does. Instead, it helps explain why the reforms that we need are actually insufficient to really fully and finally address conditions. For a more relevant example, just yesterday, seven Democrats voted to continue and increase funding for ICE, right? In spite of all the terror they're unleashing out in the open now, theory helps us look at the behavior of the Democrats who voted for this mess over their careers, so we can see that their rhetoric, what they said about being powerless because they don't control Congress and they can't do anything except to ensure oversight over ICE by insisting on body cameras and reports to be included in the funding package. Theory helps us see that that is exactly what it is. It's empty rhetoric that attempts to give cover to the fact that Democrats have never opposed funding the abuse of largely Black, brown, and poor people before now. We talked about that at length last week and a few shows ago. Theory also helps us demystify who is really on the side of the people. When we look at the words of politicians like Jasmine Crockett, who a lot of people love and believe is on the side of the people, because, you know, she has the homegirl kind of vibe and you know, that's kind of cool. I like it. She can be funny sometimes. But y'all, we don't need comedy and girl boss attitude right now. We need leaders with people-focused morals, principles, and courage to stand up for what is right for humanity, not their pockets and not their political party. So when we practice the theory, we learn and investigate the truth of what Crockett actually supports by looking at how she votes. And when we do that, the view is very different. So we are just at 30 minutes past the hour, folks. So you know what that means. It is time for a WPFW station break. So, engineer extraordinaire, what do you have on tap for the people today?
Calling all brothers. Calling all black men in the DC and DMV for a meeting with Million Man Vote to plan our impact on the 2026 DC and regional elections. Saturday, February 7th at 10 a.m. at Matthews Memorial Baptist Church, 2616 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast. Free breakfast and parking available. Registration information can be found at mmv.eventbrite.com. Inside of the pain, that's when I picked up the pieces and I began.
I am all for free breakfast every time. Thank you so much. I appreciate that information. So let's pick up with our girl Jasmine Crockett. Because listen, Crockett did not vote to fund ICE and DHS, which is what Democrats voted for yesterday. But a few days ago, she did vote for HR 7006. What is that, you might ask? It is the Financial Services and General Government and National Security Department of State and Related Programs Appropriations Act, which includes at least $3.3 billion with a B dollars in security assistance for Israel. And it was not the first time she has voted in favor of sending money for universal health care for white Israelis and for bombs and surveillance technology for everybody else. Voting to fund U.S. imperialism in Israel is not an outlier that reflects just a misunderstanding of what Israel really is on Jasmine Crockett's part. Unfortunately, the reality is worse. In April 2024, she voted in favor of a $95 billion foreign aid package that included military assistance for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. All the countries that are proxies of the U.S. that are involved in imperialist aggression or outright war against the so-called enemies of the U.S. that have actually never done anything to this country or the people in it, other than to be opposed to U.S. hegemony and neoliberal economic policies that destroy stability for working class and poor people through privatization of public services and laws that prioritize profit and corporate rights over people and human rights. Ms. Crockett supports arming all of them against the will of the people here and in those countries, and against the interests of truth, justice, and respect for the sovereignty of other nations and their people in upholding the imperialist and, quite frankly, white supremacist ideology of the U.S. government in attacking these nations based on their capitalist racist lies. But because people in this country don't like to read, and too many who say they want to change this system refuse to read and understand history and the theory that comes from it, we keep missing all of the guilty parties responsible for the state of chaos in this world today. Reading history and understanding the theory it informs helps us have much more clarity on who all of our enemies are. And additionally, theory helps us identify the key structures of power, not just individuals, not just groups of people, but structures, how they're connected, who the primary decision makers and players are within, how they're organized, and where they are most vulnerable. This is the map of organizing for social change that theory helps to chart. From this map comes the strategy and tactics that move spontaneous or individual outrage or outrage at an individual issue into organized, calculated, strategic action to challenge the system that produces these conditions. We are responding to the individual conditions right now. We are not responding to the system that created all of it. So, for example, people are rightfully upset at the brutality that's wholly illegal being carried out by ICE right now. It's horrifying. It really is horrifying. And it's horrifyingly illegal that the current regime controlling DHS and ICE issued a memo in May of last year saying that ICE agents have the authority to go door to door looking for immigrants to kidnap, detain. Don't want to get the station in trouble. But the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, you know, that piece of paper that these people said all this time for decades, they were so deeply committed to, along with the Bible, that ain't none of them read. They say the Constitution that they claim they love says that individuals have a right to not be subjected to, quote, unreasonable searches and seizures, end quote. That's the Fourth Amendment, and generally requires a warrant issued by, and the language in the Constitution is exactly this, quote, neutral and detached magistrate, a judge, based on probable cause to enter a private home. The ICE memo allows agents to use what are called administrative warrants, and that is really just a form that exists within the Department of Homeland Security to enter homes without a judicial warrant. That stupid piece of paper, it's the form I-205. That piece of paper is the equivalent of a sign on the break room door to wash your cups and not leave them in the sink, because administrative warrants are internal documents generated by ICE officials themselves, not by a judge. And they have never been sufficient for legal entry into a private home. Many, these people really do think that just because they want a thing to be so, it is going to be so, regardless of what they have been telling us settled law says. So if they believe that, why do they believe that? Well, that's because that's how they've governed the entire time. Sure, they pass laws that say they can't do this thing. And then when they feel like doing that thing, because it's going to benefit them in a material way, they basically look at that law and say, yeah, we don't care. And we're just going to do this thing. And you're going to let us do it. And usually the law lets them do it. And even if the law says they can't, somehow they still find a way to get what they want. Now, many people are rightfully outraged that the agents and representatives of this regime would all of a sudden not care about their precious constitution anymore and blatantly violate the law as they clearly always intended to do. And they know full well they were planning to do it, because why issue a memo saying you can do a thing if the thing was always done? They knew it wasn't done before. They knew it was illegal. So that's why they issued the memo to say, I know what the law says, I know what the Constitution says, but we're saying, go ahead and kick them does in. We'll worry about the lawsuits when this regime is over. That really is the attitude. The problem is the illegality of this regime is where people stop. This regime. While the violence committed against people being kidnapped by these goons is horrendous and an escalation from the way immigration was inhumanely done by every administration in the past, it is not really that different from what we've been experiencing before from previous regimes, just in different contexts. Let me tell you what I mean. Aside from the history that we started with at the top of this show that sounded almost exactly like what is going on in the streets right now, think about the way colleges and universities responded to the pro-Palestine, anti-genocide, anti-Zionist protests on campuses since October 2023. Think about the way protests against racist police terrorism have been violently suppressed throughout the entire history of this country. But okay, for your own memory, think back to 2015, okay? How about the brutal destruction of what may have been the largest organized protest against capitalism, at least in my lifetime, that was Occupy Wall Street? Every one of the presidential regimes that unleashed local and federal law enforcement on those movements were Democrats. Republicans came along and were like, yeah, let's keep doing that. We like the way y'all did it. But here's a different spin on it. But Democrats unleashed that repression on the people. The repression of Palestinian and pro-Palestinian students across the country over the last 2 years was carried out by Biden and Harris. Students were expelled from school, denied graduation, or outright detained by ICE and deported for opposing genocide. But remember, Jasmine Crockett and the Democrats call Israel an ally, right along with the Republicans. But the same U.S. politicians were not allies to their own constituents when they were doing the Israelis' bidding in criminalizing students and the masses, demanding an end to genocide. So is the problem we're facing with ICE today solely about Trump and these new ICE agents? Or is the problem much bigger? Is it a bigger systemic issue that involves every institution in this society that will do whatever those in power tell them to do to shut us up when we threaten their status quo? That's the problem. Without understanding theory, you will never get to even asking that question because you stay stuck on getting rid of the latest and most visible contradiction while ignoring all the ones in the shadows you can't immediately see. Analyzing the problems we face through the lens of theory helps a group of people from different backgrounds, life experiences, and even social statuses develop a shared framework and vocabulary to understand and communicate complex ideas efficiently and build a cohesive strategy. Group study is key. This is why organizations do group study. Everybody who comes to an organization doesn't believe the same thing. We don't have the same understanding about the same thing. You know, people come into anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist organizations not really understanding what capitalism is. Well, that is why we have internal study about these topics. We have group reading. We have group discussions about what we read and study. And that is how we develop a shared understanding, a shared vocabulary, and we can get together and work on a shared cohesive strategy. Through this approach, clear goals are developed along with the strategies and tactics to achieve them. When a movement's goals are not clearly defined by a deep analysis of the real problem, they're easily co-opted. Demands are watered down into insufficient reforms that leave the core system intact. And a solid theoretical foundation helps the movement hold its line, distinguishes allies from adversaries, and remains focused on its long-term goals. This is why large demonstrations like the No Kings marches face so much criticism from people like me, from established organizers and activists. The demands of those rallies were muddled, unclear, and provided no pathway to answers to the core issues facing this society today. First, there's no king in this country. So what do you mean no kings? But there is a dictatorship of finance capital and bloodthirsty capitalists at the top of every industry and in Europe, in this country and in Europe, who are invested in the repression that they have grown over the years. Getting rid of Trump is a good emotional message. And of course, he does need to go away. But once he's gone, and there will be a time when he is no longer president, what will the No Kings folks do about J.D. Vance, Stephen Miller, Mike Pompeo, Kristi Noem, and the like? Well, what are they going to do about them? But more important than those folks, what are they going to do about the Jeff Bezoses, Elon Musks, the Adelsons, Peter Thiel, Alex Karp, Joe Lonsdale, Stephen Cohen, Nathan Gettings, Bernard Arnault, Ronald Lauder? Oh, you don't even know who those people are, do you? They'll continue to control the industries that support Trump's policies and U.S. imperialist policies pushed by both parties when he's gone. They are currently supporting those policies through their various industries. You're just going to have to look them up to find out what industries they do represent, because that's a part of understanding theory too, knowing who you are fighting and what institutions they are connected to. You may have their products in your home. The last one, I know some of you do. Some of them are in your purses and your pockets right now. What did No Kings have to say about them? Theory teaches us to look beyond the figurehead and see who is supporting, pushing propaganda for, shaping their products or marketing to amplify, and using the money you spend on those products to fund politicians and policies that are destroying people's lives. Because we will still have to deal with those people and their continued impacts on our lives once the alleged king is gone. You feel me? Theory also connects today's work with the history of people's struggles. And I don't understand how you can want to be an organizer today and not want to know the history of organized struggle that leads us to this point. Helping today's organizers learn from the past, because theory is the condensed lessons of past struggles, is something that organizers today cannot get away from if we're serious about what it is we say we want to do. The analysis of the systemic issues of the past and people's responses to them is an integral part of the analysis of the problems being addressed today. There is no way to conduct an accurate analysis of the present issues without understanding the history that preceded and contributed to them. You mean to tell me you didn't know anything about the history that we started this show with, and you think you understand what's going on right now and why it's happening the way it is and why these people are doing the particular things they're doing in the particular way they're doing them? You don't. You do not. Because you don't understand that history we started with and the theory that comes out of that history about white supremacy and the violence connected to it and why they carry it out. You think that what is going on today is solely attributable to Donald Trump, when it's not. It is attributable to this nation, what it is, how it was founded, and the ideals that it grew on. If we actually read and learn history, like the history of how the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the Black Liberation Army, the Weathermen, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Sojourners for Truth and Justice, if we learn how they organized, what they believed, how they were attacked and destroyed, we wouldn't be as confused today about who to trust, who to organize with, and who to stay away from, and how to stay alert to infiltration, among other lessons on how to protect ourselves from state attack. We would also learn some very, 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 very valuable lessons about how to conduct ourselves with each other inside our organizations, because unresolved and festering internal conflicts can do as much to destroy an organization from the inside as an agent infiltrating it can. History shows us this time and time again. And the resolution of internal conflicts for the safety and security and integrity of the organization, that is the theory that comes out of knowing the history of what unresolved internal conflicts can do to damage an organization. By studying the theories that emerged from the Haitian Revolution, the Paris Commune, the Russian Revolution, Chinese Revolution, Black Liberation Movements, peasant movements in Latin America, and other anti-colonial struggles, organizers learn what tactics worked, what tactics did not work, how movements were betrayed, how hierarchies reemerged, and other issues and questions that give insight to us into how to build more resilient structures. We cannot fully and effectively answer the question, what is to be done about what's going on now, without understanding the history of revolutionary theory, which comes from what people did in response to what was going on then. Without this, organizers today spend a whole lot of valuable time reinventing the wheel, repeating past mistakes that previous organizers documented so we wouldn't have to repeat them, building structures with little protection from both external infiltration and internal division and collapse, and ultimately end up tilting at windmills with no direction, no strategy, no real goal. This is where my resolute position on not organizing with the right wing in this country comes from. I don't know every bit of history. No one knows all history. But I know enough of the history of this country to be convinced that whatever two things, a MAGA or an alt-right or a white Christian nationalist, and I agree on, like Medicare for all, and eliminating war, ending war, their opposition to my very humanity is never going to turn out good for me and the people I organize with and about. History proves the theory that the central role and racial, the central role of racial resentment among much of conservative America is a nearly insurmountable barrier for any real unity between us and them. Racism and racial anxiety are key tools in the modern conservative electoral strategy. And we have talked on this show about how the moral majority organized itself to become the powerful juggernaut that it is. The left sees addressing systemic racism and discrimination in general among all marginalized groups as a moral imperative for what we do. This is the single biggest fault line. It is. Any alliance that requires us to soft pedal racial justice will fail. They all have. And too often, members of the left have been willing to soft pedal racism to cozy up to the right for social media platform growth and bigger YouTube checks, while the people who are the targets of the racism and the racist violence, the xenophobia and the homo and transphobia and the ableism and the ageism, yeah, we get more marginalized by their new right-wing friends, and then the so-called folks on the left start telling us to shut up. And in the end, none of us on the left gets anything good, but the right gets a boost from support from the left. History shows us this over and over again. But because we don't like to read and we don't think theory is important, we keep falling for this stupid red-brown alliance lie. And we keep ending up exactly where we are right now, with the right coming into power and the right basically saying, hey, thank you, idiotic leftists or progressives or whatever you want to call yourself, for believing that you could work with us on the two things we agreed on. Now, open the door. It's ICE. Oh my gosh. We have so much work to do before us, dear friends and listeners and viewers. It is I feel like I have been holding in this frustration about people's, about the anti-intellectualism that has been fomented among our people in this country in so many ways. Just aside from the direct attacks on public school curriculum, the direct attacks on CRT and teaching history as it actually happened, to include all of the racial atrocities. It's not just that. It is also the way this system uses celebrity as a buffer class to dumb us down, to not pay attention to things that we should be paying attention to because they do impact us. We get all excited about our latest celebrity, I'm just going to say it. We get all excited about Beyonce and the Cowboy Carter, and everybody's got the fans and the where them fans at and all that kind of stuff. And everybody ignored what she was peddling. Americanism. in the midst of a genocide. She's sitting on a white horse with a white blonde wig, with a white cowboy hat, with a red, white, and blue sash, with a gigantic American flag. And y'all paid all that money for that woman's concerts, and she didn't say nothing about genocide. She didn't say anything about local police training with the IDF and coming back here and putting their knees on black and brown folks' necks. That is the role of celebrity in this capitalist, imperialist, settler colonial system. This system uses everything at its disposal to distract us from what it is doing, including convincing us that our real problem is those immigrants over there. It has been wild to me to see African-descended people celebrate, cheer, call ICE on people, talking about their ADOS and FBA and descendant of slaves, and they're Americans, and these people are coming here stealing black jobs. People believe this. They are easily convinced by this because they don't read. They do not know the history of struggle of our people. They don't think theory is important. So they literally do not know that they're being lied to by the propagandists for the state, and they are literally believing and living the white supremacist lies about immigrants and about themselves, because they ain't American. Honey, if we were American, we wouldn't still be having to fight for the right to vote. Let's be serious here. I'm not in a position to tell you what you should and should not do. And I think I really want to get away from giving people advice, because, you know, sometimes that's just energy wasted. What I will say is that if you are serious about organizing, you do need to read. You need to study and understand history, and you better know some theory. Because if you don't, what you're out here doing is doing your own personal TikTok video. You're not organizing for changing anything. Because if you don't know who you are fighting, why you are fighting it, you don't know how to fight them. And if you don't know any of that, you are not going to win anything. That's all the time I have tonight for Darker Than Blue. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Jackie Lukman. Stay tuned for Garland Nixon on News Views, and you all online on video, Black Liberation Media and Facebook. Stick around. Thanks so much. Aluta continua, the struggle continues. But if we keep staying close to this history and this theory, victoria acerta, victory is certain. Peace.
Who are darker than blue, don't let us hang around this town and let what others say come true. We're just good for nothing, they all figure. A boy's grown up shiftless jitter. Now we can hardly stand for that, or is that really where it's at? We people who are darker than the blue, we got no time for segregating. Let's go.
For more than two decades, Jazz Night in D.C. at Westminster Church has presented the best of the D.C. area jazz scene every week. To celebrate the program's 27th anniversary, international artist and DC diva Sharon Clark will grace the stage on Friday, January 23rd, with her quintet featuring Paul Carr, Kenny Rittenhouse, Chris Grasso, Stephen Arnold, and Lenny Robinson, and a special guest appearance by Bobby Felder. Details at westminsterdc.org.
At 89.3 FM, this is member-supported WPFW, Washington.
Good evening, it's just about 6 p.m. in the nation's capital. The name is The Show is News Views. My name is Garland Nixon. I'm on every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. here on WPFW 89.3